From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. North Carolina ranks ninth in the nation for most racial progress. That's according to a new analysis published by WalletHub, a personal finance website that frequently publishes studies based on demographic statistics. The indicators of this racial progress include voter turnout among African Americans versus whites. North Carolina took first place there, but we're talking about the 2012 presidential election. That was before the heavily challenged voter ID law went into effect. In the 2016 presidential election, turnout among African American voters was down by more than 8% in early voting, but that's one indicator. Today, we're going to hear from two women, both professors, both African-American, who have navigated the halls of higher education as students and then as faculty. Cerise Glenn is an associate professor in communication studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She is also the program director of African-American, African Diaspora Studies. Cerise Glenn, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you.
Also with us today, Candace Thompson is an associate professor in the College of Education at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. She is a teacher educator in the field of the social and cultural foundations of education. Candace Thompson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rachel.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Do you have a question about what it's like to be a person of color in academia? Have you had your own struggles with how people see you or your own worry about proving yourself? Give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Candace Thompson, you've said that most of the people who want to be teachers, the ones who come through your program, are white, middle class, and female. Mm-hmm. Where are the blind spots in sort of broad strokes for the people who come into your classroom?
Many of my students, certainly not all, but many of my students, and this is a nationwide statistic, come from gated communities or communities where there's very little opportunity to meaningfully engage with a diverse populace. And our schools are highly segregated, so it's difficult for them to see the world through others' eyes. And that's a big blind spot for them. They're also just young, so they're still figuring things out. They still carry many of their parents' politics and beliefs, and those are all being challenged in a new context.
Cerise Glenn, you've written and studied the experience of being a woman of color in academia. You have your own personal experiences to spring from, and you've written a chapter for the book Presumed Incompetent, a look at the intersections of race and class in women of academia. In your research for the part of this book that you wrote, you talk about a woman of color who walked into a classroom the first day of class, and what happened?
Well, I interviewed several women, and this story that you're referencing stood out to me as salient. And it's interesting you bring that up because she was crying when I did the interview. So I say that to say it's a classroom experience that's part of the everyday interaction. And oftentimes when we think of macro level issues, we think of systemic issues, demographics, and we forget the everyday discourses. Mm-hmm. So this particular student was in a biochemistry course. It was a large lecture course. It was a predominantly white institution. And it's a class that doesn't have a lot of minority students who enroll in it. So she decides to take the class by herself. And as a larger context, part of what some of the students do at predominantly white institutions, they'll take classes in groups or in pairs, so not the only one. So she decided to venture out and take this class on her own, and on the first day walks into the classroom, and the professor assumes she's there to change a light bulb that had blown in front of the whole entire class. So she was very embarrassed and humiliated. She sat down for that course, but never went back to that class again. And it stuck with her so much that she changed her major from biology to psychology. So she did not want to have any of his courses anymore at all. And so we forget that sometimes the everyday things that happen that the professor may not have, I'm assuming it wasn't intentional, and may not have thought about, again, had a very prolific and profound impact on how this student saw that classroom. And even her major.
And you say you'd like to think that it wasn't intentional. Mm-hmm. We don't know because the professor
right.
wasn't interviewed for this.
But that's a good springing off point. Timothy Tyson, professor at Duke University, writer, historian, white Southerner, born and raised, writes in his book, Blood Done Sign My Name, that, quote, white supremacy permeated daily life so deeply that most people could no more ponder it than a fish might discuss the wetness of water. Candace Thompson, in your work teaching the teachers, you require your students to self-examine. So how do you help them to discover the wetness of the water in which they live?
Much by experience. So many of my students are freshmen and sophomore, and they have an idealized understanding of what it means to teach. They all love children, and I want them to love the one that is harder to love, the one that they may not recognize. And so I take them into schools, in generally underperforming schools, and we build relationships with children. We read a lot. Sonia Nieto, who is an educator and researcher, talks about the smog of racism, very similar to what Dr. Tyson is talking about, that it's the air we breathe, we don't notice it. So linking that experience with these readings and then self-reflective exercises, we try and peel back those layers bit by bit and look deeper at what does love mean? What does loving a child mean? How do we problematize that in a way that helps us look deeper at ourselves?
Do teachers need to love their students to be good teachers?
You need to respect your child, and that is a form of love. You need to see your child, see those children. That is a form of, that's a demonstration of love. And to understand the context in which they live and in which their families live and thrive or not. That's a demonstration of love, and that's what I try to get at with my students.
Cerise Glenn, as a student, you encountered some what you found to be pretty shocking assumptions about you and about your background from teachers. What were some of those assumptions that weren't correct that you ran into when you were a student?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because it reminds me of the point about the intentionality and not assuming, is that when people often hear statistics or demographic information, they assume you're going to be part of that statistic or demographic information, and it becomes sometimes stereotypical. So for instance, even when I was interviewing for jobs or even when I was in a classroom, people would assume I would have a connection to first-generation college students. And they were assuming I was a first-generation college student. And even when I repeatedly said I'm not a first-generation college student, the response I got was, oh, that's right, your mom went to college. Yes, and so did my dad. So this assumption of how education is in Black families or how it's celebrated or not is one I've had to negotiate quite frequently as a student and even as a professor. And also an assumption that when you're in the classroom, sometimes I have been asked, and so have many of the students that I interviewed, to speak on issues for Black people, particularly if I'm the only African American in a classroom or in that particular course, like I really can speak for all things encompassing for African Americans. And those are things you start to learn as an undergraduate, even in high school, that you're going to have to learn to negotiate or navigate some of these assumptions. And they come across sometimes like compliments. Like, you're really well-educated. You sound very articulate. Well, why wouldn't I? Like, what is it about me that you're assuming where you're struck by how intelligent I sound, which says more about you than it does about me? But you're going to be the one that has to bear the brunt of those presumptions and those stereotypes.
So how do you make that decision to accept the mantle of spokesperson or not? In this case, you chose to go into a field of study
right
around this and start looking at some of these assumptions. You could have also said, that is not me, and I reject that mantle. What?
Well, as a student, I did so very strategically. So the first time that happened to me in one of my honors classes where I was the only African American in this course, I decided not to say anything to the professor right away, but I went to his office hours and had a conversation. And then I also wrote this scathing essay about the treatment of race in our class, in our textbook. So for me, my way of processing things is initially to just sit back and think and observe, and then to articulate it later. So as I've grown in my career, I've gotten better at voicing it as it's happening in that moment, not in a way to attack, but in a way to question, okay, why do you keep referencing first-generation college students? Then they'll say, oh, because you're not a first-generation college student? Why do you have that assumption? And even if I was, what is it that you think culturally that means for my experience? And then that process of questioning and interrogating is kind of how I get into having that conversation with people. And sometimes you'll decide it's not worth it, but generally I try to at least start to have that conversation.
Did you have to work toward building that awareness of seeing that happen in the moment? Because so many people, when they feel like they've been insulted or there's been some kind of aggression perpetrated upon them, they don't realize it until later. It's like a delayed reaction. Did you have to cultivate that?
For me, it wasn't the awareness I had to cultivate. It was the reaction I had to cultivate. Because I was very cognizant of when I spoke up in certain ways, it looked like you're really angry, and I should be just so honored and happy to be in this privileged space that how dare I complain about something. So for me, it was more cognizant of not being disrespectful, but balancing that with making sure my voice was heard, which is why the first time that started to happen, I would not say it in the classroom because I didn't want to rub the professor the wrong way, and I was afraid I would look disrespectful or too angry. So to give myself time to calm down and then go to the office hours later, I began to realize that what I was also doing was self-silencing that moment where other people weren't hearing my reactions. So learning over time how to balance the voice in the moment with being respectful and not looking too angry.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're exploring the challenges unique to women of color who work in institutions of higher education. Professor Candace Thompson of UNCW and Professor Cerise Glenn of UNCG are with us today, and they're taking your questions on this Wednesday. The phone lines are now open. You can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. What challenges do women of color face when they choose to navigate the halls of academia, both as students and as members of the faculty? We're exploring that question today with Cerise Glenn, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and Candace Thompson, Associate Professor in the College of Education at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. If you have a question for either of our guests today, or if you would like to share your own experience in higher education, call or email us. What challenges did you face that you didn't anticipate? Were your worst fears confirmed? Did you find an open and welcoming atmosphere? What do you wish the majority of the population understood? You can call us on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Professor Glenn, you were talking about how your response to essentially racist assumptions about when you were a student coming up in a predominantly white institution, some of the ignorant remarks that you would get and how you chose to deal with it. And you talked about always being aware of it, but the way you've dealt with it and the way you've communicated about it with the perpetrator has changed over the years. Candace Thompson, what was it like for you coming up? Did you attend a predominantly white institution?
I did. I began, my first 3 years were at a small liberal arts college in western Pennsylvania, and many of the kids who attended the school were, from coal mining families and manufacturing families, knew each other. It was a school of about 800 people at the time, 27 of whom were African American, and I was marveling at Cerise's poise and her ability to be so thoughtful and so strong as an undergraduate and not feeling empowered at all as an undergraduate myself. I was a biology major at the time, and I was always the only one in a class, and in my general ed classes, always the spokesperson for black folks, and usually questions that were quite racist in their assumptions about me. So it was I never felt empowered to speak up. I was torn between wanting to be accepted and knowing in my heart that how I was being treated was wrong.
And so what was the fear if you did speak up?
That I wouldn't be accepted, that they would I knew the assumptions they were making about me as a black woman on that campus. I knew, and I didn't want them to be right. And I thought that to speak up would have made them right. They would have seen I was angry, that I was resistant, obstinate, and just not as smart as they assumed I was. So I got a lot of, oh, you're so articulate.
That is a big part of your research, Cerise Glenn, in Presumed Incompetent. You write about the fact that there is a perception that African-American women, and are we talking specifically about women here,
yes,
are not as smart. They have to prove that they're as smart as their peers.
Yes, there is. And it depends on how one looks at what you bring to the table in terms of intelligence. And in our society, particularly majority culture society, we look at intelligence as something I can quantify or credential. And women are often seen, if I have this credential, something else came with it besides the intelligence, whether it was an affirmative action policy, or whether I'm related to somebody, or whether I just got here by different means because I'm so nice. So there's this assumption of, or I should say this assumption, that there's not the assumption that your degree equates intelligence the same way you may see with other professors in the classroom. So even sometimes on the first day of class, students, unless it's an area about women or gender studies or African-American studies, and I wouldn't call it a hostile environment, but sometimes the students will test you or quiz you in certain ways to make sure you can teach this class. And they challenge your credibility in ways where they don't think it's disrespectful or rude, but in a way, you're really asking me if I belong in front of this class.
Can you give us an example of how that might manifest itself?
Right, where if you look over the syllabus, there may be a scholar on here and they'll say, can you tell me a little bit more about this particular person? Or, well, how do you know what this means? And so what that does for me as a professor, especially when I was starting out, it made me feel like I had to over-prepare. So even before my first lecture, I made sure I knew every date, every fact I could about the subject and tried to anticipate every question I was going to get. So that if somebody were to say, well, what do you know about this? I had an answer ready. And I didn't feel like it was okay for me to say initially, you know, I don't know, let me research that and come back to you. I feel like I do need to know. So even though that's not something that I would say is debilitating as a role as a professor, it does start to wear on you a bit when you realize you come in and people are not going to assume you're credible in some of the classes you're teaching.
Would you consider that a microaggression?
Yes. As a fact, I'm working on a piece now on microaggressions where people, particularly in parts of the South, think about overt stories of racism, that this is what racism looks like. And some of what people navigate that's incredibly difficult are the smaller, everyday little cuts that start to dig and wear on you, and that being one. And especially when you sometimes share that with colleagues, they'll, in a way, minimalize it, and not intentionally, but it can feel like I'm not being heard. Or they say, oh, it's because you're young, you're in your 30s. Well, I'm not the only professor here in my 30s. I'm not the only young professor, and this isn't happening, from to my knowledge, to other professors. So don't minimalize what's happening. At least hear what I'm saying, acknowledging it, acknowledge it's a problem. Not asking you to fix it, but at least hear my voice and acknowledge it's happening.
How do you know about this? That question doesn't sound like a microaggression. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a pretty open insult.
Well, I think in terms of, from the student's perspective, may look at, well, it's my job, even my right to question or ask. And I do say that in the first day of class, please ask me questions. And the questions I get, they may say, oh, it's about this material. And in a way it is. But what you're really asking me is, how well do I know this material? Which can feel like more of a, it's not an overt challenging you of, or where did you get your degree? Or how smart are you to do this? But this sense of I'm asking you a question around a topic that says, I have some doubt about your competence in this classroom.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today about what it's like to be a woman of color in American institutions of higher education, and we're taking a closer look at the intersection of race and gender in academia for students and for teachers. With us to answer your questions, Cerise Glenn, Associate Professor in UNCG's Communication Studies Department and Program Director of African American, African Diaspora Studies, and Candace Thompson, Associate Professor in the College of Education at UNCW. You can ask your own question of our guests on this Wednesday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org or give us a call today at 910-343-1138. Darcel from Leland, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm with a group, Leland Ladies for Legislative Leadership, and what I wanted to ask both of the professors, I've been in your shoes before. I initially was a biochemistry major, but I finished in the arts as a designer. And I want to know how in academia can we promote some of the progress that we've made as women, specifically in the Coastal Carolina community. We're going to have a premiere of Hidden Figures, and this is about the three brilliant African-American women at Nassau. This, I had no idea of this story, and I went to the university, and this was not shared. So I just want to know your perspective as far as how to introduce unlike or unknown information to your students, and how not only exposing, engaging, and embracing. And I hope you would be available to come to our forum at the theater at Mayfair this Saturday at 12 p.m. So I just wanted to get your interactions, talking about Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson, who really had a pivotal role with John Glenn, the astronaut, in our space race.
Candace Thompson, thanks so much for your call, Darcel. Good to hear from you.
Yes, thank you, Darcel, and I may yet join you down there at 12 p.m. I want to take my daughter, who's 13 years old, and my father wants to go see it as well, Hidden Figures. How do we make it known? I think every day I go to work and meet with my colleagues and work with my students and link to young people beyond the university, that I am doing my part to show the progress, to invite people to be a part of that progress. We can have things like what you're doing. There has to be a deep and intentional way of connecting with young people, I think. We may know some things. Those of us who are in the academy or in different positions of power, success, we may know some things, but we have got to link those efforts with young people in the community so that progress is shared, modeled, and perpetuated.
We had a question. Elizabeth from Wilmington asked about the professor's thoughts and opinions on the issue at UNCW. This was a recent event that made national news. A young woman, a student at UNCW, was called out by a professor there with her full name published in a public piece saying she is bringing a queer Muslim jihad upon campus. She wound up leaving UNCW because she didn't feel safe, but not before saying that she felt personally threatened, and that's why she was leaving. In this case, the student was a person of color. She was of a minority religion and minority in this culture, anyway, in the States. And she was a gay woman. So how would you respond to Elizabeth? Because there are a lot of people out there who heard this story and want to know how you balance that, the right to free speech, the right for members of the faculty to express themselves and to challenge students and to challenge students' thinking and students' own self-identity and support students. How, is that a line that was crossed in this case? Candace Thompson.
As personally, not as a representative of the university personally, and as a teacher, yes. It was a line that was crossed. Daily, I challenge my students by introducing them to controversial and difficult material that they will struggle with, that they may be angry about, but we will discuss. We will learn how to dialogue and deal with some of those tensions that come up. But we will not attack one another. We've been given a charge, and my job is to engage in the challenge. My job is not to attack. My job is not to even try and change their minds. It is to introduce them to a world beyond the one they know and invite them to participate in that. But to attack a student in any form, when we have the power as professors, is personally unethical and wrong.
In one of your exercises, Candace Thompson, with your students, you engage your students in what you call a poverty simulation exercise.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that, how that goes, and what students get out of that?
It's a simulation that's put up by the Missouri Action Committee. So it's years in the making. It's a pretty high quality activity. And it simulates a town, a city, a neighborhood, a community with banks and pawnbrokers and, you know, various services. And students work in family groups or they're alone, and they have to navigate in 4 15-minute weeks. All the things that a family might have to do. So getting kids to school, getting to your job, finding a job, getting someone get sick, taking care of that. And students initially begin it as though it's a game of Monopoly, even though we try to prep them for that. And then they slowly come to realize how very frustrating it is and the challenges that people face.
And what kinds of challenges do they discover that they weren't aware of before?
The amount of time and energy it takes for the simplest of tasks. If one does not have a vehicle, having to take a bus to get from your job and then get to your child's school, if the kids are out of school, not having child care, lack of reliable health care, food insecurity, managing limited resources.
And how does that awareness help that person be a better teacher? Why does that matter that she understands that?
The experience itself is just one aspect. So you can go through the experience and say, well, this really gave me some insight into people who might be struggling financially. It's when it's linked to classwork, when it's linked to work in the community, that it becomes to have meaning. So there's layered understanding. And they realize that when I'm a teacher and I'm asking for $4 here, $3 here, for a family that may have 3 or 4 children, that's not right. When I am saying that, accusing parents of not being involved because they're not at the school, that is not indicative of one who does not care, that there are other challenges and contexts with which we may not be familiar with. And so I hope it makes them more conscious of their students and their students' lives and makes them more engaged.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the unique challenges of being a woman of color in academia, in American institutions of higher education. With us today to answer your questions, Candace Thompson of UNCW's College of Education and Cerise Glenn of UNCG's Communication Studies Department. If you have a question, you can give us a call on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Doc from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think this is a very interesting program. I'm enjoying it. I have one quick anecdote and a question. Back in my younger days, I worked for a couple of years in a manufacturing facility where there were roughly 35 black African-American men working with me, roughly my same age, and one white man besides me who was our boss of all of us. During that time period, many, many times I would be asked what white people think about this or what the white opinion is of that. And I never took it, I always took it not that I was going to have to express or speak for all white people, but I never took their question me of white person's viewpoint in any negative way. I just assume that that's what happens when you are a minority in a large group. And I heard one of the other ladies making a similar comment earlier regarding how in a classroom situation she would be asked to give the black person's or the black people's view of the way, whatever, the world worked. And I'm just wondering if she also felt like me that many times these are just innocent ideas and they don't mean, I never felt like I was meant to be speaking for all white people. I hope that makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah, Cerise Glenn. So Doc became by default the white spokesperson in his work situation many years ago. How do you sort of process that when you, because your conscious mind knows that most of the questions and the assumptions that are made about you because you're a woman of color are not intentionally racist, but...
Yes, thank you for sharing that story and for your question. Part of what happened in this particular classroom, to give you more context, is it wasn't as if I was called on every day in this class. So for this particular class, we're reading a lot of Shakespeare. I wasn't asked my opinion on Macbeth, wasn't asked my opinion on Romeo and Juliet. I was only asked to give my experience when we covered Othello. So the fact that I had no voice that whole semester and wasn't called out, but I was only called out on the one particular time where there wasn't a black person in the particular play, gave me the context to say that it was something that was very much raced. Because if I had the opportunity to chime in for the conversation, if I was pointed out, or if the other white students were asked about their experiences when we covered the vast variety of plays, I think it would have been a different experience. But to the point about asking when you don't know, yeah, there's times where that happens and it is an innocent question. So people are asking from a space of, I would like to know more about this. Can you tell me more about an innocent question? Sure, that's fine. But when you have that position of power as the professor in the classroom to give voice and then to minimize certain voices, it does have a bit of a sting to it.
You're listening to Coastline. That was Cerise Glenn. She is an associate professor at UNCG. We also have Candace Thompson with us from UNCW's College of Education. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're hearing from two professors who also happen to be women and African American. Cerise Glenn teaches in the Communication Studies Department at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She also directs the program of African American, African Diaspora Studies, and she researches the experiences of people of color, particularly women who've launched themselves into the world of higher education. Candace Thompson teaches cultural competency, the social and cultural foundations of education, to those studying to be teachers themselves at the University of North Carolina Wilmington's College of Education. And you have one segment left, just a few minutes, to ask your own question on this Wednesday by calling 910-343-1138 or emailing us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Cerise Glenn, just before we went to break, you were answering Doc's question about how you deal with when you're thrust into the position by default of just, it's assumed that you're the spokesperson for all the African American people. You're the spokesperson for all of the minority students in an institution of higher education. And he was saying, when I was thrust into that position as a white person several decades ago in a workplace, I recognized that a lot of the questions that were coming at me about being white and how white people think were innocent questions. How do you process all of that?
Well, I think it also connects to larger discourses of power and privilege. So, for instance, in that particular space in the classroom, one thing that I always keep in mind that professors have to keep in mind is that they're speaking from a position of power. So they very much have a lot of influence on how the conversation in the classroom is going to go. they can decide what classes we put on the table, or even decide if they want to be that professor who doesn't even allow questions. You do have a lot of control in the classroom. So in that space, when you're dealing with undergraduate students, they students may not feel like they have the right to challenge you in certain spaces. So you're not coming in on an equal playing field of power. And even the notion of privilege comes in more hidden, subtle ways where I didn't feel like in that situation I had the option to opt out. So for every other conversation we'd had along those plays, I didn't say anything at all for those particular topics. And nobody else in that class was asked to on the spot about how they felt about one particular character. So that sense of my experience is very different in this classroom than my peers.
We're talking about when you were in a class about Shakespeare and all of the classic plays came up, Romeo and Juliet and what were the other plays that you studied?
Macbeth.
And then Othello came up.
Right.
And Othello, of course, is an African Danish person. Sorry about that, Shakespearean scholars, but of African origin. And you were asked only about how you related to him.
And the other reason why that felt like an issue for me was it came up in a way where race was problematized. So it wasn't as if race is an experience all of us have, which we all do. And part of the hidden part of privilege is understanding that for certain communities, particularly communities of color, race, ideally, you're brought up to be affirmed in it, but you're also brought up to see it as a threat or a challenge to other groups. And that's something that often majority culture doesn't have to experience. So in that space, I felt like not only are you asking me about race and how I feel as a black person, you're asking me about how this race functioned as a problem in this particular play. And that's something that was a little hard for me to swallow at the moment, so I opted not to say anything and talk to the professor later. But it didn't feel like a neutral question at all. So it didn't come across as innocent, given the power and the privilege that professor had and given how race was positioned in this class.
Now, as members of the faculty, both of you, assumptions are also made about your role at work and what you're expected to do. And in some cases, this puts you in a position to have a larger workload, basically, than your white colleagues. Can you speak to that a little bit, Candace Thompson?
Yes. When I first came to the university, I was pretty protected by my chair in terms of the kind of committee work that I would do. But there were clearly some natural affinity for wanting to be on a diversity committee or doing different work. Later, it became wanting to ensure, you know, have a voice on search committees as we try and diversify our faculty more. And there was part of it was me wanting to have a voice in those spaces. But the larger part was people wanting you there as to serve as that voice. Almost in a way, and certainly no one would say this was true, this was our intention, but this is how it plays out. So they don't have to do the work. I'll be the one that will remind you we need to have more people of color here so other folks don't have to do the work. So we're often doing the heavy lifting that leads to not just a heavier workload, but a heavier emotional load that one has to carry as well. And I had to protect myself as I became a more experienced professor about what I was going to lend my voice to and my time and energy to and take care of myself, and that it was okay to say, no, I'm not the spokesperson here. I'm not going to be the diversity police for you.
Was that a hard place to reach? I mean, were there ever fears about if I don't agree to do this, then I'll be seen as shirking responsibility, or did you struggle with that?
Always. That's the conversation always in the back of my head. How will this play out? What you were saying, having the ability to opt out, feeling like maybe you can't because of various distributions of power, people who are expecting certain things of you. So, yes, it was difficult.
Cerise Glenn, this is something that you've actually researched. You've spoken to women who are members of the faculty, and this actually impacts your work as a researcher, this expectation.
Yes, it can. So when I was interviewing graduate students who were interviewing for jobs as professors, some common themes came up in terms of role overload or service expectations. So one interview in particular, that happened where this person was asked over the phone. They do phone interviews sometimes first. Are you willing to supervise this club that works on dance, even though this person can't dance? Are you willing to be on these diversity committees? Are you willing to be on another student club committee? And then in the interview, it was asked, well, how many committees do faculty tend to serve on typically their first year? Oh, none, we protect them. But you just asked this person to do four things? Well, their time is supposed to be protected. The other way it can sometimes impact professors is in terms of the scholarship, where when you navigate the ropes of promotion and tenure, your work gets validated, and I'm using validated in quotes, of what was valid research and what has impact. So sometimes if you have to hit particular journals, the journals that are open to work on diversity may not carry as much impact in terms of how it is evaluated in promotion and tenure than other types of journals, which means if you're at an institution, let's say where they use a point system for a journal, you may have to publish two book chapters to carry the same weight as one journal article. So oftentimes, just by choosing the field of where you work means you're going to have to produce more in terms of research to get the same credit that somebody else may do.
And you were also taught early on when you made this decision to go to college that you were probably going to have to make a choice, a personal choice, between having an academic career and having a man or a family.
Yeah. Also, what happened in the interviews I did was I wasn't even looking at this. I was looking at the professional, organizational, educational piece. But what also happened to come up with these students and that I interviewed overwhelmingly was how it impacted their personal life. So part of what was happening with students who go to college, this happened in one of my courses. I remember in one of my sociology classes that the statistic of a black woman with a master's degree statistically has a higher chance of being struck by lightning than finding a suitable partner, given how women are taught to marry demographically, which is the assumption that you're going to marry at your socioeconomic status level or higher and at your educational level or higher. Now, just so people know, black women actually don't tend to marry that way all the time. But that struck me as, wait a minute, and he said it so casually. And I'm thinking, are you just telling me that if I decide to get a master's degree and I have a PhD, that my chances of marrying or having kids is diminished down to nothing? So that kind of struck me. And as I was interviewing undergraduates later in life, I was a professor at the time, they were talking about, yeah, you don't go to college anymore to find your partner. I realize I may make a choice where I just don't get one. Or if I get a partner, I'm going to have to navigate a lot of stuff at home I don't feel like, where they call it superwoman or double duty, in addition to being the scholar. So I might have to have two different types of identity I negotiate.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about the unique challenges for women of color in higher education. We have with us Cerise Glenn of the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and Candace Thompson of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington's College of Education. You can ask your own question of our guests on this Wednesday. You have a few minutes left. Email us at coastline@whqr.org. or give us a call at 910-343-1138. We've talked about what this is like internally for a woman of color going into college or university as a student, and then what it's like for a woman of color to be a member of the faculty. But what about, we've heard, and then Cerise Glenn, you've also talked about the fact that we need to recognize professors in positions of power are responsible for how they speak to their students. And what do white people need to do to kind of expand their thinking about this and, I guess, their awareness? This is a hard question to ask because in some ways, just being forced into the position of spokesperson all the time for a particular group, it's white people saying to you, do the work for us. Tell us what to do. And instead of the white person undergoing self-examination. So in light of that, are there things that our listeners who have never been in the minority population can take away from this and say, oh, I wish I'd known that, or this is something that I need to think about in terms of the way I approach people in the world? And there's thought going on in the studio.
I've got lots to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. However, this is a precarious space for me. And I was talking to Cerise about this, that in the past couple year or so, I've felt very angry, a bit disillusioned, and very frustrated with some of my colleagues, with administration, with the political climate in the country, and my students in some ways. And but so for me to put myself in a position to say, dear white people, is a precarious place to be. It is unsafe, and I can already feel unsafe. I'm already navigating multiple platforms on a daily basis just to get through the day and helping my daughter navigate those same spaces. I will tell you what I tell my students, or what I try and impart to my students, that you have to know somebody, first of all. You need to get out and know somebody. You have to move beyond your own community. You have to take the risk of being the only one, of actually hearing another voice, of being in a space that doesn't feel comfortable, look like you, sound like you, walk like you, live like you. That it has to happen. I can help provide entree to some of those spaces as your teacher, but beyond that, you must do that work. You must speak. When people back somebody up, I've told my colleagues this, that when I am speaking, when I stand up and risk speaking because I refuse to be silenced about something, or I need to stand up for something, don't nod your head in agreement. Back me. Stand up and back me. So if you hear something that is important, a matter of justice or equity or something that impacts all of us, but a person of color is speaking it, stand up with them. Don't just nod your head. You're right. I need you next to me. Also carrying that mantle, doing your own work. I ask my students to look at themselves. Look at where you've been. And what? How does that shape your worldview? And then examine that fearlessly. Examine that. Find critical friends who help you examine that. Do not expect me to do the work for you. I'm tired of explaining and teaching that. My students, I'll continue to do that. But for other folks, we know what has to be done. We know the work that has to be done. So do it.
Cerise,
I'd like to add on to that, to observe and advocate and to create spaces where people feel comfortable having conversations with you. I feel pretty fortunate that when I was an assistant professor at my university, I was able to have those conversations with my department head. So he actually, my office was next to his, and he would just see all these black students coming into my office for hours and actually made the comment of, wow, you really do talk to students more than the rest of us do in terms of who we could see in that space, not necessarily everybody in the university. And when I talked to him about, I made the mistake of assuming if people asked me to do something, it was because it was my job. So when I talked to him about, here's all the stuff I'm being asked to do, he actually said, you tell them your department head said no, that I'm the one who's saying you're not going to be on this committee right now. And so having that behind me made me feel like it was okay for me to say, my department has said for my first 2 years, I'm not doing this kind of service. So to do that, to have to make that space comfortable, I felt okay to talk to him about it, but also to observe and to see what's happening, and then to advocate to protect the people who are dealing with some of these organizational and climate issues on the campus that others may not see.
And Candace Thompson, we have just a minute or so left, but you do a poetry project with kids.
Yes.
That you bring your students to, the student people who are studying to be teachers.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that quickly?
Yes. It's an 8 to 10 week program at Williston. Work with 7th graders and past 6th graders where the intent is that students get to know their students and learn something about one another through spoken word. So we learn about different types of poetry. We focus on poetry that represents the students there culturally. And then we perform at the end of the semester.
That's this edition of Coastline. Candace Thompson, Cerise Glenn, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Join us for Thursday's Coastline when we meet an extraordinary young man who is blazing his own trail as an actor despite an unusual disability. That's tomorrow on Coastline. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org or get the podcast from the iTunes store. Tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.